As a station, we believe in playing content with artistic and cultural merit, and sometimes that category includes material which can be construed as offensive. For those who have children nearby or are sensitive to provocative material, the following broadcast may have strong language, themes, or be otherwise objectionable. Please consider tuning out and revisiting CITR after this program.
Hello and welcome to Synchronicity, talk radio for your mind, body, and soul. I'm your host, Marie Bernard, and today we are speaking with Dr. Rachel Harris, and we'll be speaking about her book, Listening to Ayahuasca, New Hope for Depression, Addiction, PTSD, and Anxiety. Rachel received a National Institutes of Health New Investigators Award and has published more than 40 scientific studies in peer-reviewed journals and has worked as a psychological consultant to Fortune 500 companies and in the United Nations. And you can find her at listeningtoayahuasca.com.
Hi, Marie. Glad to be with you.
So welcome to the show, Rachel. Now, what exactly is a New Investigators Award?
Oh, that's an award that NIH gives to people who have recently received their PhD, and it's to encourage them in research. So it's kind of to mentor them to become a career-long NIH investigator. And the bad news is I completed the three-year project, and then I had a baby. That didn't take 3 years, but that ended that career. And for me, that was a terrible loss, which I really never got over. And 30 some years later, I went back to my research mentor and we did this research study on ayahuasca. And we had a great time. We both came out of retirement to do the study. And that really resolved that loss for me.
Beautiful. Now, in the end of your book, in the appendix, there is a questionnaire for people who want to take part in a research study.
No, the research study is complete. Oh. And I included the questionnaire because people found it so helpful to them. It was a chance to reflect on their experience in ayahuasca ceremonies and write about it and in a way, almost explain it to themselves. It's full of essay questions that really focus on how have you changed? And that's really been the point of the research. As a psychotherapist, I wanted to know how are you different as a result of your ayahuasca experience?
All right. Well, just in case anyone listening isn't familiar, what exactly is ayahuasca?
Ayahuasca is a concoction made from two plants found in the Amazon jungle. And it's used as a medicine in indigenous communities there. And the two plants, one plant is a vine that's called ayahuasca. The other plant is a shakuna plant, which is from the coffee family. And by combining those two plants and boiling them together, they make the DMT. And oh, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Oh, okay. They make the DMT, dimethyltryptamine, in the brew available to the human system so it can be absorbed. And that's the psychedelic element in the tea.
Now, just so I'm understanding, Rachel, there is a documentary on Netflix about DMT. I think it's called I forget the name of it. But is that a chemical that's released when we die, or is that different?
Well, there is research that's been done that this is DMT happens to be endogenous. That means that we do produce it in our own system. And there's, I think, some research showing that we produce more during the coming and going, the dying and birthing. And but there's not a lot of research about it as an endogenous chemical. And I think the DMT, the spirit molecule, grew out of a book that was one of the first scientific studies of any psychedelic since the early 70s. But that study involved injecting DMT. So that's quite different from drinking the ayahuasca tea in a ceremony. And they actually stopped that research because they found that people were having such unusual experiences, they were not able to integrate them, and they were not therapeutic, and were just too far out, basically, might have even been harmful. So that's a whole different process. And there's another different process that I want to distinguish as well, is some people in the underground will smoke DMT, and that's like a 10-minute experience. It's very intense, difficult to integrate, and not exactly therapeutic in the same way that the ceremonies are. So I want to distinguish those uses.
All right, so let's talk a little bit about the difference between having some kind of spiritual or emotional healing and just getting high.
Well, nobody describes ayahuasca as getting high because it's such an uncomfortable, challenging experience. I mean, people, it's a purgative, which means people vomit and or have diarrhea. So nobody describes this as getting high. And so it's also not going to be used in music festivals where there aren't a lot of bathrooms because that's the critical thing you want, is a nearby bathroom. So nobody describes it as getting high. And even very experienced people are nervous and kind of humbled before a ceremony. So it's not going to be used recreationally because it's basically so unpleasant most of the time. And then there are moments of great, sometimes ecstasy or psychological revelation or mystical experience. But you, there's no way to know what's going to happen. I mean, you can have an intention about what you want to get out of a ceremony, but and you can navigate within the ceremony, but you can't really control it. It's a very powerful psychedelic. And so set and setting are extremely important. And I really caution people to choose wisely if they want to experience this, what retreat center they go to, who they work with, what they're actually drinking. There are real risks involved.
All right. Thank you. Well, we are speaking right now with Rachel Harris, PhD. She is the author of Listening to Ayahuasca, New Hope for Depression, Addiction, PTSD, and Anxiety.
You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. Nisiyam, Nisiyaya, Thinkum Queen Ansep, Hydra CM, Nisiyam, Nisiyaya, and the Skakuya, Tilitin, Homasqueam, Mustayo.
An enabled FM chip in your smartphone can make the difference in an emergency situation by allowing you to still hear critical updates. It will also let you listen to the local FM station using 3 times less battery and 20 times less data than streaming. Visit freeradioonmyphone.ca to see how you can get involved by contacting your carrier and signing our petition.
Are you interested in Indigenous issues?
Are you down with decolonization?
Do you have something to say
or have a topic to share?
We have just the thing.
Join UBC's first ever Indigenous Radio Collective.
We're a team of Indigenous and non-Indigenous people.
I'm Niska from my mother.
From the Tahltan Territory.
I'm a settler from Washington State.
I'm from the Qualicum and Musqueam First Nations.
I am Quechua Indigenous from Saraguro, Ecuador.
We broadcast from the traditional, ancestral, and unceded land
of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
Whatever you want to talk about, we're into it.
Everyone is welcome, no experience necessary. Unceded Airwaves airs Mondays from 11 a.m. to 12 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM.
Follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Unceded Airwaves.
We want to hear your story.
As a station, we believe in playing content with artistic and cultural merit, and sometimes that category includes material which can be construed as offensive. For those who have children nearby or are sensitive to provocative material, the following broadcast may have strong language, themes, or be otherwise objectionable. Please consider tuning out and revisiting CITR after this program.
We are speaking right now with Rachel Harris, PhD. She is the author of Listening to Ayahuasca, New Hope for Depression, Addiction, PTSD, and Anxiety. Now, let's talk a little bit. Do you think we should talk about the dangers of ayahuasca first?
Well, I'm kind of already into it, so I would just add one more, because people travel to South America for ceremonies, and there have been cases of women being raped in South America, sometimes by the shaman.
Wow.
They can be rendered. Yeah, so this is a really serious, careful process if someone's interested in it. And the other thing is there are also there are contraindications for people with any psychiatric history of psychosis or bipolar disease. So this is not to be entered into lightly. Now, having said all those horrible warnings, I also want to say that the potential for healing is beyond our Western understanding. In other words, I actually resorted to calling some of what people described. I said these are miracle cures, that if someone could wake up the next morning after a ceremony, which goes on all night, and say, I'm never drinking alcohol again, when they were basically in trouble with alcohol, and then they don't, that's a spontaneous healing. And the same thing happens with depression. People wake up and say, I just never felt as depressed ever again. And after a lifetime of depression, I've never sunk that low again. I've always been able to manage it. So those are the kinds of things that people report. I did a study that was published in a journal and evaluated 81 people who gave a report of their experience after an ayahuasca ceremony in North America. So these were Westerners who were seeking psychological and spiritual healing. And so these quotes come from those 81 people. The reports are amazing. And it's even detailed small things, like one guy wrote about how he'd basically been a womanizer all his life and was in his 60s. And he said after half a dozen ceremonies, you know, over a year or so time, over a period of time, he said, I'm now seeking more meaningful relationships, authentic relationships, where we can be honest and real with each other. That's quite a change. So the people report changes in the ways that, we can't even imagine. But these are the kinds of markers that, as a psychotherapist, I would look for to show that the person is making therapeutic progress. People say, I feel better about myself. Not that my self-esteem is higher. It's not like that. It's that I'm more compassionate toward myself. I'm kinder to myself and to others, more accepting. There's a real groundedness to the way people describe their changes.
And Rachel, how long do you track people for? Because I know from my own experience, I've had periods where I've had epiphanies and deep spiritual growth and connection, but they haven't really lasted that long. It might last a few days, a few weeks, maybe a few months at best. So how long are you tracking these people and their ongoing results?
Well, I have not tracked 81 people forever. That doesn't happen. But there's about a dozen people I'm still in touch with. So I know they are not in trouble with alcohol. I know their depression has lifted. I know these are real changes. And there's research in general about psychedelics. Mostly, most of the work is being done with psilocybin now. And they're also following people up in a more systematic way, but smaller numbers. And people have experiences that stay with them for the rest of their lives. One of the people who just interviewed me recently described an experience from his very first ayahuasca ceremony, which was maybe 30 years ago, in which he was really given a lesson to be more emotionally expressive to women. And he said, that was a lesson that was hard earned, and it changed the way I am with women for the whole rest of my life. So I have to say, this is different than just that kind of momentary revelation. These are changes that really reorganize the personality. And so people behave differently consistently.
Thanks, Rachel. Now, you mentioned, obviously, the book Listening to Ayahuasca, New Hope for Depression, Addiction, PTSD, and Anxiety. Again, if you're interested in learning more about that, you can go to Rachel's website, listeningtoayahuasca.com. You mentioned that some of the contraindications are mental health issues, and I know that a lot of people with histories of depression can also perhaps have undiagnosed bipolar disorder. So how are people being screened to know that this is safe for them?
Well, let's be realistic. There's almost no screening. In the States, in Canada, this is an illegal drug. Except for the very few churches that are connected to Brazilian churches. And there's one in New Mexico and two in Oregon. And they've gone through the court systems all the way up to the Supreme Court to get the legal right to use this concoction as a religious sacrament in their services. So they're the only ones who can use it legally. So it's... you know, people are entering into the underground. In Peru, it's not an underground, but shamans and retreat centers in Peru do not do psychiatric screening to any great extent. Maybe a few of them do, where there's a strong Western influence, but the indigenous people don't screen psychiatric issues. So people have to really read about this medicine and educate themselves. That's part of why I wrote the book, so that people can know, understand more about what they're getting into, and decide whether it's for them and if it's and what's the best way to approach it.
Thanks, Rachel. So what would happen if someone did have an unknown mental health issue, undiagnosed schizophrenia, bipolar, something that could make it dangerous? What could happen to them?
Well, there are reports of people having a manic psychosis afterwards, or going off the deep end in one way or another. And there's always that risk with a psychedelic experience. And so this is really why, with the research on psychedelics that's been going on for the last decade or so, great care is taken. And the setting is, it's a home-like setting, but it's generally done at a medical center. So that's, of course, not the case with ayahuasca ceremonies. You can be out in the jungle or out in nature or in somebody's living room. So the risk is always a psychotic break. And there are reports on the internet of people who really struggled with anxiety after a ceremony. So it's very important for people never to be left alone, always to have people there to reassure them and basically make sure they get their feet back on the ground. So there's no question that there are real risks. And if somebody has an undiagnosed psychiatric illness brewing, there's no way for anybody to know, even with a screening. So it's by definition undiagnosed.
So with that in mind, something like schizophrenia may not even develop until someone is around 30. Is there an age that you would most recommend ayahuasca for because of those kinds of risks?
No, we don't know enough, really. We don't know enough to be able to set those kind of guidelines. What was really interesting, I had a very interesting experience at a ceremony. A woman, it was the mother of... someone who had been attending ceremonies, and she and her husband, the man's stepfather, wanted to experience what their son was doing. I mean, the son was 30-something and a lawyer, so the parents were maybe around 60 years old, high 50s, maybe 60. But the mother had a diagnosis of schizophrenia, and she'd been on a lot of medications for decades to control the illness. And I was really concerned about her experience and what she was going to do afterwards. And I spoke to the person who was leading the ceremony, and he said, I knew of her psychiatric history, and I gave her less than a teaspoon. I mean, I gave her like a few drops so that she could be in the ceremony and experience the spiritual ritual, but not really have to deal with the medication, the ayahuasca. It was such a tiny amount. It was almost like a homeopathic dose of a few drops. So the experience itself was very meaningful to her. And in this way, she could share in what her son was doing, what was so important to her son, but she was also protected. But that's a situation where the person leading it was very sophisticated and very careful. And I was quite relieved to hear how that was handled.
Thank you.
But not everybody's going to do that.
Well, that's the thing. I guess it's a case of really doing your research and like any, if you want to call it a medication, I mean, even if a doctor prescribes a medication, there are risks to taking those.
There are always risks with medications. That's right. And in the research studies, of course, with psilocybin, and there's some now with LSD, there's pretty extensive screening going on. So these medicines are psychedelic drugs, they are not to be played with. And we don't want a repeat of the 60s and early 70s. This is we have to have matured as a culture and find therapeutic and spiritual ways to work with these opportunities.
Now, just to clarify, is psilocybin, is that like magic mushrooms?
Yes, that's mushrooms.
Okay.
Yeah.
I wasn't.
So that research is being done at Johns Hopkins. And so they've published many, many studies that are really quite remarkable. And they're focusing in on the what they call complete mystical experience as being the therapeutic variable, that's what leads to the biggest life change. And the life changes they're looking at, I mean, one study, this is, just seems very mundane, but one study they're doing is smoking cessation. You know, quitting smoking is one of the most difficult drugs to quit. Tobacco is extremely addictive. And so after, I think it's 2 psilocybin experiences, if the person had a complete mystical experience, they were more likely to be able to abstain, to quit. And of course, they really follow people up. And they don't take their word for their report on whether they're smoking or not. They actually test to see if tobacco is in their system. So, I mean, what tobacco costs this country in terms of illness and disease and early deaths is amazing. And 2 psilocybin experiences, for that to make a significant difference, is an incredible option. So, and there's also research with people who have a terminal cancer diagnosis. And a similar thing happens there, in that the people become more comfortable with their own dying process. Their anxiety is lessened. They're more available to their loved ones. It changes the whole process of dying. So there are incredible therapeutic opportunities with the psychedelic drugs, and we're just learning how to use them.
Thank you. Again, we are speaking with Rachel Harris. She is the author of Listening to Ayahuasca, New Hope for Depression, Addiction, PTSD, and Anxiety. And you can find her at listeningtoayahuasca.com. Now, would you like to share a bit about your own personal experience with ayahuasca?
You know, part of what is unique about ayahuasca, the word itself is means, it's translated into the vine of the dead. So there's something about this medication that opens up it opens up the portals between the living and dying. So my very first experience, I went back to the time when my father was in the process of dying under hospice care. And I had brought him home from the hospital, and he was being tended to by hospice nurses. And a day or two before he died, you know, the breathing changes and it gets very intense. And I'd had a very intense sort of out-of-body experience. I was in the room right next to his bedroom, and I became very frightened and stopped the experience. And so in my very first ayahuasca ceremony, I asked to return to that time and be able to complete that experience for myself. So this was the only time when I had an intention and I actually experienced what I asked for. And so I went back to that time with my father. I lived again my last conversation with him when he was still conscious. It was, you know, his final words, the final message to me. It was that last chance to say, I love you. I mean, this was very emotional. And then the experience of leaving my body as he was dying so that I was kind of going on the journey with him. And because I was determined not to be afraid and shut it down, I sort of zoomed up out of my body into the cosmos. And I had this ecstatic experience where it's not even correct to say I had an experience. My eye disappeared into the grandeur of the cosmos. It was this cosmic experience. And that psychological opportunity to say goodbye to my father again, that spiritual experience of connecting to the other side, to the process of dying, that's really stayed with me. This is over a decade ago. And it's really stayed with me as one of the most important experiences of my life. And it helped to resolve those difficult hours of his active dying. It helped me to come to peace with that process of witnessing his dying.
Thank you. And what kind of long-term, a couple of questions, how many times have you used ayahuasca and what kind of long-term changes have you noticed in your own life?
Well, you know, in the churches, people have ceremonies every couple of weeks or once a month. So the pattern for within the Brazilian churches is pretty much every 2 weeks. And there's research that shows that there's an antidepressant effect and it begins to decline after about 2 weeks. So those churches intuitively knew the right frequency. That's not what I'm seeking in this medicine. I maybe will do a ceremony once or twice a year. So that's not, you know, and I've been at this now for about a dozen years. So that's not a lot of experience. I mean, there are people who have done hundreds and hundreds of ceremonies, and I'm not in that category. My expertise is not in traveling to South America and being, you know, extremely brave and courageous in the jungle. That's not my expertise. I'm really a coward. So my expertise really comes out of a lifetime of doing psychotherapy. And having a research background helps. But it's been sitting with people, and I saw a very narrow range of people in psychotherapy. I saw people who were functioning pretty well, but were interested in their psychological and spiritual inner lives. And those are the same people who are seeking ayahuasca ceremonies, who want to grow and open and develop their inner lives. So I've had a lifetime of working with these people.
So it sounds like you're saying that this would not be for people who are not functioning very well.
Well, it would not be. It depends on the personal circumstances. Everyone has to. It's not like I can recommend it to a whole class of people. People almost have to be called to seek this experience. I mean, people have come up to me and said, you know, I'm having dreams about ayahuasca. I've read a little bit about it, but I see her in my dreams. Well, they're being called in a certain way. So it's not like I'm recommending it or not recommending it to any group of people. There's an inner process that has to call you to this experience.
Thank you, Rachel.
So that's mysterious in itself, isn't it?
Yes, and you referred to ayahuasca as her just a moment ago. Can you say more about that?
Yes, you know, this was the finding in my study that I just have to say pretty much blew my mind. Even though I am one of those people who literally hears a voice, and I don't have a background of hearing voices other than my own inner reminders, but I heard a voice that I identified as Grandmother Ayahuasca, and she asked me to do the research. So I was literally having an auditory experience. But people In the study, I happened to ask the question, do you have an ongoing relationship with the spirit of ayahuasca? And I didn't take this question very seriously. A very experienced female shaman who's a high intuitive person, she suggested I include this in the research, and so I did. But I didn't realize the finding I would get. And 75% of the people reported yes, they had an ongoing relationship with the spirit of grandmother ayahuasca, and they would communicate with her in their dreams, in meditation, intuitively. They would call upon her. They felt she was always available to them for support and guidance. I mean, it was a remarkable finding for me. These are Westerners. So this is not part of the Western, worldview to be having a communication and conversation with what is basically a plant spirit, the spirit of a plant. And some people like myself heard her voice. So this is how people talk about her. I mean, even that example I gave earlier where somebody was describing how they received the lesson of communicating more emotionally with women in their relationships. The way he reported it was in a relationship exchange with ayahuasca, with grandmother ayahuasca, that she just was not going to let him off the hook on that. She just kept confronting him. He denied it. He skirted it. And she just kept after him. And finally, he had the realization, yes, you're right. I have to change. So, and, that was 40 years ago during his life. So, these are life-changing experiences. But there you get a sense of an interaction, almost that grandmother ayahuasca is functioning as either a stern grandmother or a psychotherapist. It's some combination of that. And that is how people talk about their experience. And I know this sounds a little crazy, but this is a highly educated professional who's describing this experience that he had 40 years ago that has made all the difference in his relationships with women. So, and this is the kind of thing I have heard again and again.
Thank you. That brings up the question. We're talking about this gentleman who needed to connect more and be more open and honest and vulnerable with the women in his life. Now, what about people who have some kind of insight for needing to change, but maybe they don't have the life skills to implement it? What happens then?
Yeah, you're asking a therapist, do people need therapy? And so, of course, my answer is yes. I mean, I absolutely do think that people would benefit enormously from psychotherapy after one of these experiences. Certainly, there's a sort of a golden opportunity in the hours, days, weeks immediately following this experience, where there's a new flexibility. I mean, I'm talking neurologically as well as, just the experience. People can make different decisions about themselves and their lives and their priorities in life. But I think things can get, insights, revelations can get lost without the support and sometimes confrontation that happens in ongoing therapy. So, it's sort of like a no-brainer. Yes, of course I recommend psychotherapy for people. There's a growing interest in the ayahuasca community about what they call integration, and that's in the immediate few days after a ceremony. And they're mostly recommending quiet time, yoga, massage, meditation, a chance to just be quiet and kind of mull over writing in your journal so that you can kind of clarify for yourself. But, as a psychotherapist, I would like to see people in a therapist's office, but a therapist who understands this realm and this process. So ideally it would be someone who has been in a ceremony for themselves, but at least that they can appreciate this realm of experience and transformation, because it's quite different from how we generally think of psychotherapy process. I mean, people really can take leaps as a result of ceremonies, and the therapist has to really understand that. But I can give you a good example of, I had someone who wanted to talk to me. She had completed the research form, but she just wanted to talk to me. So it was basically a research interview. And at some point, it morphed into a therapy session. And she was saying how she experienced the female archetype, you know, and this was helping her understand who she was as a woman. And it was, you know, someone in her mid-20s or so, and just getting a sense of herself in the world as a woman, and how this was so inspirational. And I listened to this for about 5 minutes, and then I couldn't take it anymore. And I said to her, "How's your relationship with your mother?" And she burst into tears. Now, that's the difference between, you know, journaling and talking about your experience and being in a psychotherapeutic process. She was in trouble with her mother. I mean, there was trouble in that relationship that hadn't been resolved. And where we went to then during our time together was, you know, she was on her way home for Thanksgiving vacation. I said, "Talk to your mom. You know, this is open up that relationship again and see where you can go now." And so she really should have had a therapist to go back to. And of course, I recommended therapy, a therapist to go back to and say, "Well, this is what happened over Thanksgiving holiday. And my mother and I are talking more, and this is what's coming up," and a chance to go over this with someone. But not everybody's willing to do that.
Again, we are speaking with Dr. Rachel Harris. She is the author of Listening to Ayahuasca, New Hope for Depression, Addiction, PTSD, and Anxiety.
Summer. 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 The summer double issue of Discorder magazine is out. Grab one right now to read features about accessibility in Vancouver, Western Front's media artist in residence, Gabby Dow, about Gable Vision, the LGBTQIA+ video history archive at Vivo, local thriving 18-year-old hip-hop artist Prado, an interview with the Chinatown Concern Group, Vancouver Latin American Film Festival. Plus, you can cure your FOMO with our concert reviews, amp up your summer playlist after reading our album reviews, and of course, there's a special taroscope waiting for you in the summer issue of Discorder magazine. Pick one up today at a stand in your neighborhood. Thanks to our advertisers, the Rickshaw Theater, Current Symposium, the Cinematheque Live Van, the Rio Theater, Audiopile, Rifflandia, and Mint Records.
We are speaking with Dr. Rachel Harris. She is the author of Listening to Ayahuasca, New Hope for Depression, Addiction, PTSD, and Anxiety. Now, you mentioned that, except for under very specific circumstances, ayahuasca is illegal in North America. Most people tend to go down to South America to do these ceremonies. But you also mentioned that you weren't going down to South America. So where do you experience ayahuasca?
So, of course, I'm not going to describe where I experienced it, since it's an underground in North America. But my first experience has happened in Costa Rica. And so that's where I really had that experience with my father's dying, and was really, it's almost like I was bonded to this. I was so overwhelmed by this experience. It was that I was sort of committed to the process. I think that's what I can say, because this is not a pleasant process for me. Pretty much everyone else does better than I do in a ceremony. I'm always the first one to vomit, and, you know, I'm pretty miserable throughout the night. So the psychological benefits have to be very strong for me to go through the physical discomfort. And so I think those early experiences really made a big impression on me, and I feel committed to this process of healing and working with myself. So that was in Costa Rica. So people do ask, you know, well, how can I find this medicine? And people have to be on their own journeys because it's not readily available. And you have to be very, very careful because there are not that many really safe and secure and legitimate places to experience it. And I want to say something else, because in our culture, we focus on the medicine, on the ayahuasca brew itself. But what happens in an authentic ceremony is a holistic experience. And that includes singing what are called icaros. They're kind of guttural songs in Spanish or some of the indigenous Latin American languages, Quechua. And so we Americans don't always even understand the words, but those songs are working with the energy during the ceremony. Now, we don't really have a scientific way of explaining this, but the songs themselves are part of the healing of the medicine. And there's an old saying that if you know the songs of the plant spirit, you don't even need to drink the plant. So that's how powerful and how integrated the ceremonies are seen, that it's not just what you drink, it's also the songs and the way the energy is dealt with by an authentic shaman. And so it's a holistic experience. And in our culture, you know, we tend to not appreciate some of these unseen processes and really understanding how the ritual is holistic, and we need a situation where we can experience everything involved. And not just drink, you know, where can I get some medicine? Where can I drink it? That's really not the right approach at all.
Well, that's the Western approach.
Sometimes it's a Western approach. And what we can really learn as a culture is how to respect the sacred ceremonies of another culture that's entering ours. It's sort of the same as, you know, there are tons of yoga studios all over the place. And so yoga has become sort of separated from Hinduism, or the spiritual path of yoga has become almost more like a physical exercise, or even meditation is separated from the Buddhist retreat process and a real spiritual process. And it's used for legitimate medical reasons, but in a secular way. And so that's our tendency in this culture, to secularize sacred rituals from other cultures. And I imagine we are in the process of doing that with this whole ritual medicine use, but I want to speak up and say, you know, maybe this time we can appreciate and respect the holistic ritual.
Now, you mentioned about the songs, the chanting, that if you know the song of the mother ayahuasca or the plant medicine, that you don't even need to take the plant. And I'd love to talk more about that, because you also mentioned that mother who had schizophrenia who went down and was able to connect with her son's experience. So I'm wondering if you spoke with her about whether she had any long-term changes just from being in that environment.
Well, you know, that's a great connection. Thank you for that, putting those two together. That was the shaman's intention for her, that she didn't need to drink. It was just being in the ceremony itself. And that was a way that she could be included in her son's life. So there was no way this medicine was going to heal her 40-year career as a schizophrenic. That was not going to happen. But it was a healing between her and her son. So it was a family healing. And the actual ceremony, because I was there, was this 30-something couple, the wife's mother, the husband's mother, and stepfather. So there were five people from this one family in this ceremony. And everybody was very moved by the love between them, and the willingness of the older generation to enter into this extraordinary experience out of wanting to share their daughter and their son's lives. And so it brought the whole family together. And many people who were present talked about, oh, I wish my mother, my father would come to a ceremony. But, you know, that not everybody's willing to do that. So that's really what was healed.
Thanks, Rachel. It brings up the idea, I have a question about maybe your opinion on this. When we're in a room with other people, we're tuned into, like, mirror neurons are triggered. So I'm wondering how much of that happens or could impact a person just from being in the room and going through that. Maybe the person
we don't go down that road. We're in the dark, so we can't see each other in a traditional ceremony.
Oh,
so mirror neurons are only stimulated when there's a visual.
Okay, input. I didn't realize it was all in the dark.
Yeah, it's at night and it's in the dark. It's very dark. Yeah. So that doesn't happen. But there is sort of a contagion in the room. There's no question. And we're aware of other people. I mean, we can hear if somebody's vomiting. We can hear them. So there is a shared experience on many levels. But everybody is focused on their own inner experience. It's sort of, you know, if you meditate alone, that's one experience. If you're sitting in a group of experienced meditators, that's a different experience. And even if you're meditating with your eyes closed, there's a sense of the combined energy in the room is supportive. I remember going to a Catholic retreat, after my daughter was a few years old. I managed to go away for a weekend to be able to just, you know, basically sleep and meditate. And I was sitting next to some older Catholic nuns who were sitting in meditation. And it was so delightful. And it's not like we talked or I had much to do with them, but it was just sitting next to them was just refreshing for me. So there is sort of, you know, you pick up other people's energies, even in the dark. And but the ceremonies are basically an intrapersonal experience. Of course, we're all sensitive to each other in a room and then hanging out the next morning and talking and sharing.
Thank you. Again, we are speaking with Dr. Rachel Harris. She is the author of Listening to Ayahuasca, New Hope for Depression, Addiction, PTSD, and Anxiety. The word listening, is that about the voice of mother or grandmother ayahuasca?
Well, not everybody hears a voice, but there is sort of, some people do, but there is a more general term would be there's an attunement to this, I don't know what, you know, this is very difficult. I remember, you know, when I got the findings from the study, I really went into kind of a worldview crisis. I had my own existential crisis, and I had very prestigious religious professors I could talk to. So I spoke to Bob Foreman on the East Coast about, well, who is this grandmother ayahuasca? And he's an academic professor who's done a lot of writing on mysticism. And I was having breakfast with Bob, and I says, okay, so, you know, who am I hearing? Who is this grandmother ayahuasca? And he just looked at me and said, we don't know. Then, you know, about a year later, I was on the West Coast, and again, I was having breakfast with Houston Smith, he's gone now, but he's a very prestigious religion professor. And I asked him the very same question, and, you know, he gave me the exact same answer. He looked at me and he said, we don't know. And that, in a way, from these two religious professors who know much more than I do about these things, I felt that I was given permission to accept the mystery of not knowing what is this voice? Who is this spirit being? This is beyond our Western understanding, and we really don't know exactly. So the question is always, well, what is our relationship to this experience, and how does it change who we are? And, you know, I can give an example of this one woman in ceremony, a woman in her late 20s who really kind of suffered in her own self-esteem and just didn't feel good about herself and was struggling about where to go in her life, was kind of lost, basically. And she said, you know, I can just tune in to Grandmother Ayahuasca, and I know she's going to be there for me. And it gives me a sense of security and stability that I've never had before in my life. And that helps me have more confidence in making my way in the world. So, you know, that's a description of what psychologically is called a secure attachment, a sense that someone is always there for you, that you can count on them. And so this is this young woman's relationship with the spirit, and we don't academically know much more about that spirit. So it's a mystical relationship, but that has great psychological advantages. So this is kind of a new ground of being for this young woman that helps her face the challenges of 20-somethings in this world. Mm-hmm. So the listening, the voice of Grandmother Ayahuasca, it's about relationship.
Is there any research looking at the brain of someone who, like, pre and post ayahuasca?
Well, there's actually a good bit of data now coming out on all the psychedelic medicines. And so the research is done with LSD and psilocybin, and then the person is put into a functional MRI machine, which does not sound like a good trip to me, but they're doing it for science. And what they find is really interesting. This is the neurological finding, is that the default mode network is deactivated. So there's less oxygen that goes. And this is not an anatomical structure in the brain. It's a network. And it's the network that's like that machinery that is just constantly going. It takes up 60% of our time. It's the constant self-talking that we do, you know, remembering lists, criticizing ourselves. You know, it's the constant thinking that's going on. And this is this kind of thinking, and it's default mode thinking when we're not focused on something else. This kind of thinking serves to uphold our personality structure as it is. So when there's less blood flow to that neurological network during these psychedelic experiences, there's an opportunity for new neurological connections to be made and a new wiring to become established. And that's why those golden hours and days and weeks are so important, because that's the opportunity to create new connections in the brain. And so that's the neurological finding, and it's matched by psychological testing that found people report greater openness after, for instance, a psilocybin experience. And openness is one of the five personality variables, psychological variables, that are supposed to be consistent throughout life and not change. And here they're finding that after one or two psilocybin experiences, people are significantly more open. So what we thought were unchanging traits in the personality actually can be changed. So, and besides new connections being born, there's also neurogenesis. So new neurological connections actually arise, anatomically. So this is an incredible opportunity after ceremony, and that's part of why, to go back to your other question, it's a golden opportunity for psychotherapy for people to make different decisions about their lives it's a chance to reorganize themselves. And even in the, you know, there were a lot of research studies in the 50s and 60s, mostly with LSD. A few of the psychiatrists would talk about the time after an experience was the time, and they actually used these very same words, to reorganize the personality. So here we have, you know, scientists from the 50s and 60s noticing this and documenting it, and here we're finding it again and documenting it with the functional MRI machines. So this is really, this is very good data, and the question is, well, how can we best use this therapeutically? And that's going to take a lot of exploration.
Well, and it almost makes a good argument for finding a reputable place in another country, because if you do it in your own environment, then in that period where you have this opportunity to rewire your brain, you're back in all those habits.
Well, you know, a couple of years ago, there was an older psychiatrist who felt he was called. And the one advice I gave him was, after the ceremony, don't go back to work. Give yourself a couple of days. Well, a psychiatrist does not always take advice from a psychologist. And so he did a ceremony over the weekend. Monday morning, he was back in his office with his usual schedule, you know, back right into, you know, a box of this is how I behave and think and experience things. And he didn't give himself that opportunity to be different and to be different with his patients. And it was an opportunity lost.
Well, we have been speaking with Dr. Rachel Harris. She is the author of Listening to Ayahuasca, New Hope for Depression, Addiction, PTSD, and Anxiety. You could find her at listeningtoayahuasca.com. And we have just a few minutes left in the show, so I'm wondering, what do you feel is one of the most important things you want people to take from this interview and from your book?
You would think I would have a set answer for that, but I don't. So I think I have been asked this. I answer it differently each time. But I think it's a real appreciation for the depth experience that comes from ayahuasca and other psychedelics, but that there's a real deep experience of oneself that has an enormous potential for spiritual healing and psychological work. So it's part of a path, and that's what, of course, that's what spiritual work is all about, is that process.
Absolutely. Well, I'm going to be doing more research. I don't know about the whole ayahuasca thing, but I am curious to know about that research going on at Johns Hopkins.
Yes, there are plenty of articles mm-hmm. published.
Thank you. So before we close the show, thank you so much for your time, Rachel. Is there anything else that you want to add?
Thank you, Marie. No, I think it's that it's a delicate combination of the risks and the benefits, and they're both extreme. So I think we covered both as well as we could.
Beautiful.
And you know, there's I would just say one more thing. There's one consistent personality trait that comes out because this is such a difficult process, is people become more humble. And there is, you know, I'm not talking about myself, obviously, but there is a sense of working at these levels. There's a deep humility that comes out of all our vulnerability in working at these deep levels. So I want to mention that as well. That's one thing to look for in people. If you're choosing to work with someone, check out that variable.
So it sounds like you're saying if the person administering or doing the ceremony doesn't show humility, that could be a red flag.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Good to know. Thank you. And again, you can go to listeningtoayahuasca.com. And yeah, I always have trouble spelling ayahuasca, but you can Google it and Google will probably tell you, do you mean this one, this spelling?
Yeah. So,
thank you so much for your time today, Rachel. It's been such a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you, Marie.
All right. Have
thank
a great
you so
day.
Much.
And thank you Thanks. For taking the time to listen and be with us this hour. I want to send you lots of love. Be well. Namaste.
Up next is Parts Unknown with DJ Chris Horrific on CITR.
We don't need to tell you that Vancouver has a housing problem.
Mass evictions.
Mass rent evictions.
Unfair rent increases.
What happened to rent control and protection from unfair eviction?
If these or other housing matters concern you, you may be interested in joining the Vancouver Tenants Union. For more information, visit tenantsunion.ca.
Friday, the 28th of July, come out to enjoy an evening in Damascus. A city as old as time is visiting you here in Vancouver, bringing authentic Syrian food, belly dancing, and storytelling, all in support of queer Syrian refugees in their journey to Canada. Hosted by Syrian activist and author Danny Ramadan at the Roundhouse on Friday, the 28th of July. Doors open at 7 and find tickets on Facebook and Eventbrite for an evening in Damascus.
Become a CITR member and make some new friends.
Members get discounts around Commercial Drive and beyond at Pandora's Box Rehearsal Studio, Bomber Brewing, Stormcrow Tavern, People's Co-op Bookstore, Mintage, High Life Records and Music, Bone Rattle.